Talk given Sunday, 9th November 1980. By virtue of our own constitution, psychophysically, and also because of our upbringing and education, possibly I should say miseducation, we grow up conscious and always thinking in terms of that which we call transcendence or God or Brahman or whatever it is, as something quite apart from us, something totally different from us. We put the distance between the transcendent and ourselves. Now, this is a very important fact. Really to see, don't just believe what I say, but really see it, that it is due to us ourselves as we are constituted, and also because of our upbringing and education, that which is transcendent is far away from us. God in heaven, as we say all the time. We forget God here now. In fact, we don't forget because we never knew, we never remembered. However, let me present the unity, the fundamental and absolute unity of all existence in somewhat scientific language. I dare say a good many scientists or intellectualists would call it pseudo-scientific language and pseudo-philosophical. However, let us consider this together very, very carefully, because it is so tremendously important. If we see this, it will really change our lives. That is to say, it will change our lives because it will transform our consciousness in a remarkable way. I want you all, first of all, to consider what we call a point, the geometrical point. We make a mark on a piece of paper and say, there is a point, don't we? Now, that is not a point, actually. That is a solid object on the piece of paper. It is measurable. You can take the sharpest possible pin and make a hole through a piece of tissue paper if you like. But that is not a point. A point has no length, no breadth, no depth. It has no dimensions whatsoever. Therefore, it has no material existence at all. But it has an existence in terms of our concept, or if you like, our arbitrary verbal statement expressed in the word point. That's a point. Now, this point has, therefore, an existence, a real existence, in our own mind, in the manner in which we talk about things. If we were to take, or that is, if we could do so, an infinite number of points and put them side by side, would we get a line? Now think carefully. We would not get a line if we merely placed points side by side, even conceptually, because to place side by side means that involves a certain gap between any two points. But if conceptually and physically on a piece of paper, just for illustration's sake, if you were to move a point, that is to say, bring the point to life. Movement means life. That living activity of the point will produce a line. But now consider carefully. A point has no dimensions. It is non-finite. It is the geometrical conceptual point is the perfect expression on the scale of the small of infinity of the infinite, the non-measurable. We think of infinity in terms of bigness. The word infinity, it never strikes us that there is the infinity of the small, the immeasurability of the small, just as there is the immeasurability of the extremely vast. So now, the movement of a point will produce a line. Now do remember, a point actually is invisible. It is invisible, it is untouchable. You can't corroborate the invisibility by getting hold of it. You simply can't. So too, a line in the perfect sense is also invisible. You can't see a line as a line. You can draw a line. We are accustomed to draw a line or something like that and do something like that and say, there's a line. But the true line, as you can conceive it in terms of geometrical perfection, is invisible. Now, if you take a line, and make it and move it in your thought at right angles to the direction in which it points, that is to say, move it like that, then you will get a surface. You can't take an infinite number of invisible lines and put them side by side. You won't get a surface. But if you move the line, bring it to life, so to say, you will get a surface which consists of length and breadth, but you won't see a surface. It will be invisible. The surface also will be invisible. For the very simple reason that we are spatially conscious in three dimensions, three integrated dimensions, 1, 2, 3, length, breadth, depth. If you have length, breadth, depth, then you see a solid object. And because you see a solid object, and because by our virtue of our constitution we are spatially conscious in terms of three dimensions, the brain can conceive of a surface, a line, and a point. All these can be conceived of by the brain. We can be conscious of these in our own way. Do you get the point? The important thing is that we, by virtue of our constitution, psychophysical constitution, are capable of a space consciousness in three dimensions. And only when all three dimensions are there, does any object come into being for us. It becomes visible, it becomes tangible. You can't hold a surface. You can postulate it, and you can define it by virtue of the fact that we are three-dimensionally space-conscious. So now, three dimensions come into being for us in our actual experience. Our consciousness is of such a nature that it can grasp all this. But our senses are unable to function unless all three dimensions are present. You can't see a thing, you can't touch a thing, you can't smell a smell, etc., unless there are three dimensions actually present all together. Three integrated dimensions. So now, where do we go from there? We come next to time. The infinitesimal moment of time is something which we are not conscious of. And I don't suppose as long as our bodies are constituted as they are, we ever could be conscious of time in that sense. So, if we have an infinite number of instants which move from one into the other, if there is the movement of time, as we say, then we will get a time span which more or less is like a time span which corresponds in terms of time to a line. Now, if we have an infinite number of time spans, we get what in our experience in the deep meditative states we call the timeless state. And therefore we get timelessness. And if we have an infinite number of timeless states, then we have the true meaning of eternity. But these remain just words. Eternity for us in the ordinary way is we identify with the timeless condition, our own condition, our state of consciousness, in which we cannot observe the passage of time. Now you see, we have wrong conceptions of time, timelessness, and eternity. Time actually is the rhythm of the living process of the entire universe. With reference to ourselves, in our own bodies, we have a pulse beat, the rhythm of our pulse, of our heart, the flow of the bloodstream, etc. All these are rhythmic as such. They are not like time, which is inflexible. Time strictly is inflexible. That is to say, time as we measure it. You can't measure a rhythm. You think that we have a beat, as we say, the conductor's beat or the marching of soldiers and so forth, but it is not inflexible. It is mechanical and it is measurable. Whereas a rhythm has that living quality which makes it immeasurable in actuality. It's an immeasurable something, it's a living something, it is actually a transcendent something. So then we get to the sort of, we begin to be able to be aware of the nature of eternity in conceptual terms only. Eternity is not the opposite of time or of timelessness. It completely subsumes time and timelessness. Infinity subsumes everything finite. If not for the reality of eternity, no dimensions would exist, and we could not be spatially conscious in any sort of dimension at all. So infinity subsumes finitude. Eternity subsumes all temporality. The timeless is also temporal, because the word timelessness in actual experience means that we enter into the state of the timeless according to our state of consciousness, whether we are in any of the deep states of meditative states, or whether we are so completely absorbed by what is happening or what we are doing that we never we are unable to be conscious of the passage of time. Time understood as the rhythm of the living process which is going on, whether we are aware of it or not. And similarly, immortality. Immortality subsumes all mortality. You've often heard me say, immortality rides on the wings of, eternity rides on the wings of time. You can just as well say that immortality rides on the wings of mortality. The life-death pulse, or if you like to use the term I prefer myself, the life, other life pulse, is something which happens not as here, there, like that, but as a simultaneity. Now this is very difficult to conceive, because there is nothing in our everyday experience where simultaneity of that sort takes place. Simultaneity of other sorts take place in our everyday life, but not simultaneity of this sort. But now notice very carefully, the infinite, the eternal, the immortal is the context of transcendence itself. It's the context of God, of Brahman, or use any word you like. You see, it's the context of the transcendent. It's the context of the primordial creative energy acting in eternity, which releases cosmos out of chaos. Now, by self-restriction, when the transcendent restricts itself, it produces the finite particulars which make up the cosmos. Now, you take again the line. I went into all this in the ordinary matter-of-fact way for this reason. Take the forming of a line by the movement of a point through space. The point itself, we saw, was non-finite, immeasurable. It is transcendent. It can only be conceived of as such. Transcendence, when it moves, instead of being in its primordial, undifferentiated state, where it is in a state of vibrant quiescence, no movement spatially. When you get the spatial movement, then you begin to get manifestation. You don't get manifestation otherwise. So a line consists of an infinite number of these points. That is to say, infinity becomes represented in terms of something finite. A line has a length. It is a finite. You can have a long line, a short line. You can't have a long point, a short point, or anything like that. You see? Now, this is the important idea I want you to get hold of, that the transcendent and that which we experience in manifestation is completely, they are both completely involved in each other. The self-restriction of the transcendent produces the manifest. You see how important this is, or do you not see its importance? You see, if you can see it this way, if you can see it this way, you can begin to see that the way we have been brought up and educated is a curiously mistaken way of being brought up and educated. We put transcendence outside ourselves, away from us. But transcendence by its own self-limitation produces us. We are transcendence embodied. How many thousand times during these 19 years I have said that? We are transcendence embodied. And actually, if you use this mathematical sort of way of starting to think about it, you will appreciate the point tremendously. It is even materially true, leave alone idealistically or spiritually or any such thing. It is an actual fact here and now that transcendence is the totality. It's embodied, you see. Now, having got that far, let us move on a little further as regards the living of the religious life. You might ask, well, if that is the fact, how is it that we are so confoundedly ignorant of it? Now, I don't mean ignorant in the sense that the brain doesn't know it. Of course, the brain also doesn't know it. But you see, deep down, we are not conscious of it. Although the fact is there, perpetually there, the fact is there in terms of eternity, actually, you see. Although that is there, our consciousness is so sluggish, we are so unevolved, we have not yet grown into our full potentiality. That is why we remain ignorant of it. And those around us are just as ignorant as we are, and therefore they can't tell us or help us to understand it at all. But if one really begins to be quiet within oneself, one can sense it. When, for example, you do sometimes experience those remarkably quiet states within yourself in the midst of the beauty of nature or whatever it is, then for a while you do sense it very, 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 very slightly. If you sense it intensely in its fullness, unless the psychophysical organism has been properly prepared, and this is where one of the deep significances of yogic discipline comes in. If you are not prepared, it shatters the organism. It shatters the organism. That is to say, not that the physical body will explode like a bomb, but it unbalances a person. Then you get all these messianic complexes and these ridiculous I am God statements when that person really is nowhere near godlike. Like that dear little Indian peasant whose name was Godly. And the author of the book writes, she was visiting India and she was living in a village there. And she said, this man was anything but what his name signified. So you see, if the psychophysical organism isn't disciplined, isn't prepared for it, then it causes mental disturbance, very serious mental disturbance. We have examples of that in our own lifetime, in the history of both Europe and Asia. We have had Hitler, we've had an Ayatollah now. We have an Ayatollah now, and so on. So we have to beware just what it all implies. The brain can take the fact intellectually without harm to itself and without harm to the psyche as such, provided we understand that all this which I've tried to present is a conceptual picture of the possibility. Now this shows us that transcendence really is our supreme potentiality. It lies within us. And it lies within us in terms of absolute bliss and absolute quietude. Do remember those points. Transcendence itself never compels. Never compels. It just sits quiet. It just is as such. And influences us by its own natural isness, just as the sun influences us, because being the sun, it cannot avoid giving out light and heat and life and supporting life and so forth. You see, it's all so very wonderful and so beautiful if we can only let ourselves grow into it. So you will see also that you can't strive after the transcendent. You cannot strive for that perfection which is represented in words like transcendence or God or Brahman or anything at all. And therefore there is no such thing as I attaining or achieving this, that and the other. Not at all, you see. Now, it's a question of consciousness. And this is where the whole story of development, as we call it, comes in. What is it that develops and comes to fruition? It is And what does it really mean? It means a transformation of consciousness. That is to say, a transformation of your mode of awareness of existence. How are we aware now? We are aware in terms of self and not self. We are not aware in terms of the complete indivisibility, the complete irrefragability of the utter unity of the totality. We are not aware in those terms, you see. And this is what is meant by growth, that a process of change takes place, a process of change in which the old state must of necessity die and instantly give birth to the new state. You have watched, for example, a bud come to flower, especially an iris. An iris does that, doesn't it? I have watched an iris. It's absolutely wonderful. It's like that, and then there's a little spurt, and then a few seconds later, another little spurt, and it goes on like that until the thing comes to full bloom. The spurts take place as a result of the sort of natural inward pressure from within to grow, and the growth implies the change, the continuous change. And then the time comes when that change goes, so to say, in a reverse direction, and it ends up in what we commonly see and call death, the end of that particular manifestation. But it is not the end of the transcendent embodied in that manifestation. Transcendence remains total transcendence, a whole, wholly unitary transcendence, irrespective of what is happening to the manner in which transcendence is embodied, is manifested. Don't think of the embodiment as, well, there is the body and here is transcendence somehow bottled up in it. Don't think of it that way. This process of self-limitation of the transcendent is an extraordinary thing altogether. The brain won't get it. You have to let the brain be quiet, and then suddenly somehow it will flash into your consciousness, and later on concepts and words will come along. And they may be misleading concepts and words, or they may be concepts and words which help your consciousness to undergo that transformation by means of which you become aware of the actuality of the truth of the whole thing. You see? So now, this process of transformation of consciousness takes place. When transformation out of the mineral state takes place, shall we say, there is an evolution into manifesting in the plant state, which is sort of more conscious along these lines than the mineral, and then into the animal state, and then into the human state. And so you see, there is this perpetual transformation of consciousness going on. Because remember that side by side with the primordial, undifferentiated creative energy, there is also pure consciousness. Don't think of pure consciousness as another thing which is side by side with the primordial creative energy. These are two ways. Consciousness and creative energy are two ways of talking of one identical reality. Is this getting too confusing or complicated? There were two new people who came yesterday and day before. They grasped part of this and they thought they'd come yesterday again in order to get clarity. And they went back saying that they were more confused than ever. I'm sorry about that, but I'm not surprised. This really isn't easy. You see, all the time the brain and our ordinary brain processes interfere, they definitely interfere with the awareness process, which is undergoing transformation. If, for example, your own body were to start undergoing transformation at some considerable speed, you might be able to see it. But because it undergoes transformation very, very slowly, you are unaware of it. You see? So the consciousness does not... There comes the time when consciousness knows itself. Don't tell this to the ordinary scientific psychologist or the intellectualist. He'll say, this fellow's completely mad. Yes, all right, I am mad that way, and I'm very delighted to be mad that way. It's a happy madness. It's a divine madness, if you like. But there it is. Now, the consciousness undergoes the transformation till at last there comes the point when you are aware as a permanent and an ever-active background of transcendence itself in its aspect of pure or absolute consciousness, animating you and moving you towards your own fruition without the brain knowing it. It's important to realize this. Don't seek to know. Don't seek to know with the brain. That is to say, with the activity of the senses there. The senses will then be true cords of communion. And in the true state of communion, there is no otherness. There is no this one in communion with that one. There is such a remarkable unity that the analytical separation of this and that is clean out. And this brings about the full fruition. And therefore, there comes the point of the perfect realization, the making real of transcendence as embodied in you yourself through your psychophysical organism. And that can happen only as and when the first steps are taken, namely through the utter purification of the psyche. The purifier is not the I am I who am conscious of myself as John Smith or Mary Brown. I cannot affect the purification. What that I can do is to observe and understand the obstructions to the pure state and to the process of purification. That I can deal with, but I can't positively say, oh, I'm going to purify myself, because I'll have a certain concept in my mind that I have to obtain this, that, and the other result. And being imperfect, of course, the mind is, the psyche is always deluded about such things. So in a way, the technique of attainment, of realization, is a non-technique. What do I do about it, people ask? The only answer is, be quiet. Do nothing. And if you can be quiet, that is to say, if the I am I state of consciousness can be quiet and do nothing whatsoever to interfere, the life process will enable the right thing to happen and the purification will take place. You know how the living cell has this remarkable capacity of healing itself when it is hurt or when it is ill. Self-healing characterizes the living cell. Now, in the same way, this process of self-healing, of letting the thing come to full fruition, is dormant in us. It is there all the time. We have to let it happen. And we let it happen by being fully observant of what actually is present and being with it, not saying, oh, I'm going to remove this and get rid of that and or change the shape of this and put this picture there and that chair there and so forth. We can do that with material things and material objects. We can't do that with our living selves. We try to, and then all that we succeed in doing usually is to produce as a new caricature of ourselves. That's all that happens. But the pure aspiration can be there. Now, what do I mean by the pure aspiration? Each of us has some sort of sense of the reality of transcendence being within us. The possibility, it is our supreme potentiality. The possibility is there. Right you are. The aspiration to let that, the longing, the pure longing, the pure desire. Remember, there are the two aspects of desire. Kama manas, meaning, of course, desire for self, which is the bedeviling factor. And there is chandas. These are the Pali terms which the Buddha used, chandas, which means a tremendous energy roused up because you are longing for this, the pure thing. In the Upanishads too, you find the same, identically the same teaching, where it is said that he who longs for the Atma, whose ultimate desire is the Atma, whose whole aspiration and effort is directed towards the Atma, he will grow, because the Atma will take him and release him into full realization. So the pure aspiration is nurtured and supported by the living process, by the activity of transcendence within oneself. How then does this affect our life and solve our problems? Because we are always wanting to solve our problems, aren't we? We all have problems. Well, start by not wanting to solve problems. That is to say, let me start by not wanting to solve my problems. And when I have become sensible enough to see that, then I will not try to solve the world problem, other people's problems, because I'll only interfere with other people. Also, I shall be doing them a tremendous disservice. Each person has to grow into his full egohood first, into his own true individuality as that particular living manifestation, his own indivisibility. When he has freed himself from his own indivisibility, his consciousness will have undergone the first great transformation towards being able to see the truth and letting the truth work through. If I go not away, the Comforter cannot come to you. And the Comforter is he who brings the truth, and the truth sets you free. I, the self-conscious, the isolatively self-conscious I am I, cannot do anything at all. So you have to let the transcendence within you work. And that is the one and only I am. It is not just confined to you or me. It is universal. It is total. It is absolute. And, all right, the absolute can do what I can never do. You know the good old story of Hercules, one of his labors, to clean the Augean stables. Now, Hercules, Mr. Hercules, by himself, he had wisdom. He had great wisdom because, after all, his dad was Zeus and his mummy was Alcmene. He was a child. He was a half-divine creature. This is the interesting thing. Half-divine, just like you and I. You see? He was a half-divine creature. So what did he do to clean the dirty stables? He looked about him. He observed, and he just bent the course of the river which flowed past, and they flowed through the stables, and the stables were perfectly clean. What a good chap. What a sensible chap. Now, why can't we be like that? that bit sensible. And we will find, therefore, that when we get quiet, the Lord steps in and does the job for us. Through us, mind you. Because Hercules also said to the fellow who was shouting for help when the wheel of his car got stuck, "Put your shoulder to the wheel, man." And what corresponds in our life to putting our shoulders to the wheel? Being observant and seeing what are the obstructions within our own selves to the activity of transcendence, the free activity of transcendence through us. So there that is how we put our our wheel to the shoulder, our shoulder to the wheel. Now there are certain other things involved here. We talk about cultivating love or developing wisdom. The very fact that the totality is transcendence embodied, and there is transcendence embodied in each and every one of us, means that love, wisdom, beauty, goodness, truth are all absolutely present within us as such. There is no need to seek to love. The reality of love is actually present here and now, because those are the words we use to represent that state of creative energy, that state of pure consciousness, because of which this entire universal process goes on. And the universal process is a cosmos. It's a cosmos, but not just in our sense of the word, where everything is pleasantly interrelated. It isn't. The interrelationship is one which, in its finality, produces a perfect harmony. But in the producing of that perfect harmony, you can get the stages where there is conflict, where there is confusion and difficulty. Galaxies collide with each other. Think of what happens when galaxies collide with each other. And the same occurs on the small scale in our lives too. We just observe. Remember how in Genesis, the beginning of Genesis, it is said, "And the Lord God made this, that, or the other, and saw that it was good." Having created it, he just sat quietly and looked on, observed what was happening. What wonderful lessons we have through our scriptures, but we haven't got the common gumption to be able to penetrate into their deep inner meaning, because we don't care sufficiently. We must all admit that we don't care sufficiently. I notice in my own life, if something comes up which is something of a serious problem, troublesome problem, then I forget the Lord and I think only of this miserable I am I consciousness, which wants its specific, particularized result. And the result is generally the discovery of what a fool I have been. So there we are. Now, love, wisdom, all these things are involved, completely and totally involved, in the fact of our existence, because transcendence is embodied in this, the limited thing, and the whole context of limitation, of birth and death, the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal is completely subsumed in the context of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. Completely subsumed, not merely contained in the manner in which a box can contain your jewelry or oranges or whatever it is that you put into the box. Not merely in that sense, but the subsumption means that there is such a complete, total, living interrelationship. There is a real integration of what we talk of, what I talk of as two contexts, one into the other, so that the absolute unity of the universe is the ultimate fact. Now, grow into the awareness of that. Let yourself grow happily into the awareness of that. That is the true meaning of learning, growing happily. In the process of growing happily, pain can be experienced. But that pain is necessary, and it gets transformed into true happiness, not temporary pleasure. This is the important thing. That is why never seek pleasure. That's the surest way of assuring yourself of sorrow and trouble. Just let the thing happen, and you will find that you will come to your fruition.